Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Salve and salutations. My name is Charles Chestnut. This is Storied History, and this story is about Hurricane Katrina. This is the one that so many people have asked me for. This is the one that so many people have gotten mad at me because I haven't given it to them yet. This is the one that I was saving until the anniversary. And here it is. But first, let's get this out of the way. Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans. This narration is an attempt to convey what happened on the ground. However, because of the chaotic nature of these true events and the different and sometimes contradictory first-hand accounts, some aspects remain incomplete or imperfectly understood. Despite my very best efforts to portray them truthfully, this in the end is just a dramatic retelling. I have endeavored strongly. I have tried very hard to maintain accuracy. But some of the incidents and events may have been altered or condensed or restructured for clarity and for narrative flow. Look, over the years, I have told this story hundreds of times to tens of thousands of people, and I could not tell you how many of those people have cried and hugged me and how many have told me that I have finally told the truth about what happened to them, about what they went through. Sometimes time brings clarity and hindsight brings understanding, but sometimes not. Sometimes time suppresses the events and a person's memories may blur at the edges, and those incidences, those events and recollections only reflect fragments of a larger trauma. As a very good friend of mine is fond of saying, the map is not the territory. And what that means is that when you condense something down, it's never going to be fully accurate. No matter how good a map is, it's never a perfect picture of a piece of land or a country because it is condensed. And that holds true here. No condensed version of anything is ever fully accurate. I'm trying to bring you a cracked window into the past, a composite understanding of what it was like on the ground, what the people went through away from the halls of power and away from those that caused the delay. In the end, this is not a documentary. It is a dramatic narration and, if we're being honest, an overly dramatic one at that. Well, it is hot in New Orleans. It is August 2025, and the heat is oppressive. It is truly the dog days of summer. The sun beats down on us and on the water. This heats up the surface temperature of the water. That is not a big deal on the Mississippi River. But in the Gulf of Mexico, the Atlantic Ocean, high surface temperatures cause powerful updrafts. These updrafts are low-pressure zones. The higher pressure surrounding air starts spiraling inward to fill it. These are called tropical depressions. Until they intensify beyond a certain point, they become tropical storms, and they are given names. On Tuesday, August 23rd, 2005, a tropical depression in the Atlantic Ocean intensified into a tropical storm. and was given the name Katrina. As I do my work on the riverboat, the Creole Queen, we pass up and down the Mississippi River, and one of the things we pass is the Lower Ninth Ward, a predominantly low-income African-American neighborhood that was the site of the worst breach in the levees, although certainly not the only breach in the city. The levees themselves. For those of you who are unaware, levees are little more than compacted piles of dirt with a thin concrete or stone shell to prevent erosion. In between the Lower Ninth and the French Quarter, basically, is a waterway which is called the Industrial Canal. That is a shortcut to the Gulf that was once used by international shipping before the ships just simply got too large. And that was the actual site of the worst breach in the levees, although, again, certainly not the only breach in the city. On Saturday, August 27th, 2005, Katrina becomes a Category 3 storm. All of the models indicated it would continue to gain considerable strength and then strike at or near New Orleans. So, at 9 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, a voluntary evacuation order was issued. You should leave, but you don't have to. Along with the following warning. Areas affected by this storm will remain uninhabitable for weeks, perhaps longer. At least one half of all well-built structures will suffer roof or wall failure. Persons, pets, and livestock exposed to the wind will face certain death if struck. Airborne disease will be widespread. Water shortages will make human suffering unimaginable by modern standards. That night after midnight, Katrina becomes a Category 4 storm. By 7 a.m. Sunday morning, it is a Category 5 hurricane with sustained winds in excess of 160 miles per hour and gusting well over 200. For you international listeners, 160 miles per hour is approximately equal to 260 kilometers per hour. So, at 9 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, a mandatory evacuation order was issued. Non-optional. You must leave. Approximately 1.2 million people left southern Louisiana and New Orleans. Around 100,000 stayed. Some stayed because they had nowhere else to go. Some stayed because they had no way to get anywhere else. Many, many stayed because they were simply stubborn, and they just refused to leave. My aunt and uncle were two of the stubborn ones. They could have left New Orleans, they simply refused to do so. Many of those that did not have a way to get out of the city were covered by the mandatory evacuation response, which they tried to activate school buses and city buses to help take the people out. Unfortunately, the voluntary evacuation order issued 24 hours before had released all city employees, so the bus drivers had all left with their families. When called up to service, they were hundreds of miles away. The buses remained empty and unused here in the city. Approximately 10,000 people went to the shelter of last resort. They went to the Superdome, where there was food and water for those 10,000. This was provided by FEMA, and it was intended to last for 2 days. And 550 National Guard troops were activated. Out of the many thousands available, the governor activated 550. Sometime after midnight, the rain began to fall, and the wind began to rise and rise and rise and rise. At 4 o'clock in the morning on Monday morning, the Industrial Canal broke open and the Lower Ninth Ward began to flood. At 5 a.m., the other side of the Industrial Canal broke and what used to be a Navy Yard began to flood. At 6, the East New Orleans levee system was overtopped by a massive storm surge. East New Orleans begins to flood. Katrina makes landfall around 6:15 in the morning. This is approximately the same time that the power plant supplying electricity to the city flooded, shut down, and would not come back online for 6 weeks. Over the next few hours, as Katrina makes its way past New Orleans, breaches, breaks, and overtops occur all across the city. There was no one single type of failure or location that the levees failed. Different things happened in different places. In some of the nice suburbs around the yacht club on the other side of the city, on the shores of Lake Pontchartrain, the levees are too short, the water goes over the top. The Four Points Canal, the levees are intact, but the floodwalls on top of the levees break. The New Orleans Canal, which was unfinished, it was the gate leading to the unfinished portion that broke. The worst breach by far, no comparison, was that leading to the Lower Ninth Ward. As the storm approached New Orleans, almost all of the traffic in the port of New Orleans went upriver. The barges, the pushboats, the container ships, they went upriver ahead of the storm. Almost all. At least one barge was left in the city. It was left in the industrial canal. When the winds began to rise and the waves began to rock, it broke free of its lines. And hundreds of thousands of pounds of metal began slamming like a battering ram against the dirt pile and the 1 inch of concrete protecting the Lower Ninth Ward. The barge punches through. The water begins to rush inward. The inrushing water further erodes the breach, widening it. By the time the erosion had finished, that break in the levees was 400 feet long. Katrina passes New Orleans a little before 10 o'clock in the morning on Monday morning, and the wind begins to die very quickly, but the damage has been done. In a dozen and a half places across the city, the levee systems have failed in some way. The wind is dying, but the water is rising. Most people in the rapidly flooding areas did not realize that they were in a flood until it was too late. The reason being, if you were in a Category 5 hurricane, or any strong hurricane, you do not stand next to a glass window and just look outside. It is far too dangerous. You've got plywood over your windows. People are in the center of their homes, away from potentially deadly flying glass. They are aware that they are in a flood when the water's coming in under the doors. At that point, it is too late to leave your home. New Orleans houses are almost all raised, especially in the low-lying areas. By the time the water's coming in under the doors, it is at least 2 feet deep outside. The flooding is coming from a point source, or sources, which means that the water itself is moving very, very quickly. You cannot step into 2 feet of fast-moving, debris-filled water and survive. Even if the wind has died down to non-lethal levels. So the people of New Orleans, trapped by the rising water, went the only direction that they could. They went up. They went to their second floor if they had it. They went to their attics if they didn't. Many, many thousands of men, women, and children in the city survived because of 6 words. That is a literal statement. Those 6 words are, keep an axe in your attic. Since the 1960s, it has been standard hurricane preparation in the low-lying areas of New Orleans to keep an axe in your attic. Many of those axes have been placed there years, sometimes decades before, and never touched. And now, as the water rises, the people retreat into the attics, and the water continues to rise into the attics, trapping them there and rising still. Those that had axes had the ability to cut their way to their own roofs and escape the rising water. Those that didn't. That was why, whenever you saw pictures or video of people stranded on rooftops after Hurricane Katrina, there was almost always a large hole in the roof. That was not storm damage. That was an escape hole. And that was Monday. On Tuesday, the first federal responders showed up, the Coast Guard. They came in big helicopters and little boats. They lowered harnesses for the men and the women and baskets for the children. They took people off of rooftops, off of balconies, and onto dry land. The other group of rescuers were the locals themselves. They were nicknamed the Cajun Navy. They came out of their own little boats, in rowboats and skiffs and kayaks and canoes and makeshift rafts, anything that would float. And they waded and they rowed into water that was still rising, into water that would continue to rise until the middle of the day on Wednesday, when 80% of Orleans Parish would be underwater. And they too took people off of rooftops, off of balconies, and onto dry land. But where would you take them? New Orleans is surrounded by water. To the south, there is nothing but swamps. You cannot go east. The bridges are heavily damaged and totally impassable. To the north are the massive lakes and the one bridge across, the causeway. If you have a vehicle that can drive through deep water, you can get out that way. If you don't, or your vehicle is underwater, to cross the causeway is a 24-mile walk. 24 miles of baking concrete in the August sun, with no shelter, no shade, no water. To the west is Baton Rouge. The highways and the bridges leading directly out of the city towards Baton Rouge were totally washed over. Again, if you had a vehicle, maybe, you could find your way on the west bank. That is the bank across the river from the main areas of New Orleans. Without a vehicle to get to Baton Rouge on the west bank at this point was an 80-mile maze. 80 miles of small roads, overflowing rivers and swamps, downed trees and bridges that may or may not still be there. So the people of New Orleans, unable to find a way out, went to the shelter of last resort. They went, or they were taken to, the Superdome. 40,000 people went. Where there was food and water for 10,000. Where there was no electricity and there was no running water. No running water does not just mean that you are going to be thirsty. It means there are no toilets. For 40,000 people. Things got very bad, very quickly. Another 10,000 went to the convention center as overflow, where conditions were similar, although they were not quite as bad. On Tuesday, martial law was declared and the looting began. Across the city, on an aggregate scale, some of what was taken was simply food and water. This is because, under the terms of martial law, you are authorized to take survival materials. That means food, water, diapers. My uncle was actually involved with a police station emptying out a grocery store completely and taking everything to the Superdome. He only made one trip himself because the rumor had already begun to spread, which he later confirmed. Do not go to the Superdome. The National Guard will not let you leave. In response to the chaos and the violence that was now spreading through the city, the National Guard, far too outmanned to impose order in the streets, chose to lock down their own purview. They simply would not allow the people to leave. They believed incorrectly that a large-scale evacuation was imminent. And operating under that belief, they surmised that it would be easiest to get the people out from a centralized location. So they locked it down. And chaos was spreading through the city. Make no mistake about it, not everything that was taken was food and water. The burglaries and the robberies began as soon as the wind died down. Clothing stores broken into, shoe stores, liquor stores, jewelry stores, pawn shops, electronics stores. There was a Walmart that was completely cleaned out. Burglaries of homes began in the areas that were still dry. Fires began, sometimes set deliberately. Oakwood Mall was looted down to the bones and the entire structure set on fire. And violence spread through the city as well as gang members and criminals with guns, driven out of their neighborhoods by the rising water, began shooting at each other in the streets, shooting at homeowners trying to protect their houses, shooting at my uncle as he tried to protect his, and even shooting at the helicopters. As the Coast Guard still searched for survivors, the country, the world, watched in horror on Tuesday as New Orleans descended into madness. By the end of the day, it resembled nothing so much as a post-apocalyptic wasteland, with roving, violent, heavily armed gangs of looters, waters still rising. Fires raging unchecked and unfought across the city. By nightfall, the only lights in New Orleans that could be seen were those fires, flashes of gunfire, and spotlights in the dark as the Coast Guard still searched. And that was Tuesday. On Wednesday, across the country, hundreds of police officers, firefighters, doctors, nurses, EMT personnel, and veterans volunteered to come to New Orleans and help out in any way that they could. All they needed was a way to get into the city. And the Federal Emergency Management Agency answered the call. They gathered up highly trained volunteers from all across this country, and they brought them to Atlanta, Georgia, for a two-day training conference where they would cover such subjects as diversity hiring policies, sexual harassment, community relations, how to use the FEMA paperwork system, and they actually had a class on the long and glorious history of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And there they would stay for the next 2 days. Across the country on Wednesday, other help began heading towards the city, more official help, as National Guard units from as far away as California, New York, began heading towards New Orleans. From California, they came in planes. From Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, the closer states, they came in trucks. But the same thing happened to all of them. As they approached Louisiana, Governor Kathleen Blanco informed them that they were not needed, they were not necessary, and they did not have permission to enter the state of Louisiana. Because they were not going to be placed under her control, and because she continued to deny placing the Louisiana National Guard troops under federal control, she turned them away. And they went home. Some of them went home. The Colorado National Guard was already flying over the state of Oklahoma. They received new orders to go around Louisiana, down to the southern part of the state of Mississippi, where the eye of the storm had passed. They did so, and they began helping out in any way that they could. The Texas National Guard had almost been fully and completely mobilized. And the governor of Texas told them, do not return to your bases. Instead, he sent them east of the city of Houston, right on the border between Texas and Louisiana. They began stacking up and awaiting permission to enter the state. They were soon joined by the California National Guard, who, rather than turning around and flying all the way back to California, landed in Texas and began waiting with the Texans, while Governor Schwarzenegger began privately pushing for permission to enter the state. Here in the city, the Louisiana Reserve National Guard began to evacuate one of the hospitals, Memorial Hospital. They organized the doctors, the nurses, and the patients. But as they began exiting the building, gunshots were heard somewhere in the neighborhood around the hospital itself. The National Guard did not attempt to locate the gunmen. They did not attempt to form a defensive perimeter. They simply got in their trucks and they drove away. The doctors, the nurses, and the patients went back into the hospital where there was no running water and the generators were failing. Memorial Hospital, the Memorial Health Centers, were not evacuated. As a U.S. Army veteran, I find that not just unconscionable and cowardly, I think it should be worthy of court-martial. The National Guard then sent three busloads of people across the Mississippi River Bridge. Because by Wednesday, the water has now finally stopped rising. And a way out of the city was found on the west bank. You take the main bridge across the river. Once you cross the river, you turn right. You take small roads 30 miles up. You have to wind your way through some overflowing swamps. But you can make it. There's another bridge 30 miles away. You take that one back across the river. If you've taken the correct bridge, you have now bypassed the washed out portions of the highways without entering the overflowing swamp. The correct bridge will drop you onto Interstate 10. From there, it is a straight, clean, and totally unobstructed shot all the way to Baton Rouge. This is on a raised highway through an absolutely massive swamp. You cannot get off the highway until you get to Baton Rouge, because there are no exits. But once you do get there, you can go anywhere in the country. But when they reached the end of that very first bridge, they had to pass through a township called Gretna. And the Gretna Sheriff's Department, understandably, yes, but not excusably, fearful of the chaos, the looting, and the violence that had spread through the city, had barricaded the bridge. As they approached the barricade, this is three busloads of elderly from Toro Hospital with the National Guard. The Sheriff's Department pulled out their weapons and began firing over their heads, turning them back to the city. The way is shut. And that was Wednesday. On Thursday, Canada arrives. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police put together a convoy of trucks with massive wheels that could drive through anything. They loaded these trucks with food and water. And then, in order to avoid bureaucratic red tape, they did not tell their superiors in Ottawa what they were planning to do. They did not ask the United States permission. The Canadians crossed the international border illegally. They drove south for 2 days. They arrived into Orleans in the pre-dawn hours of Thursday, with no fanfare and no advance notice. No one had any idea they were even on their way until they were already here. They drove in through the north, across the causeway. Because if you have a military-grade truck with four-foot wheels, you could drive in and out that way, no problem. The Canadians began distributing food and water to anyone that needed it. This was greatly appreciated, and it was desperately needed. But in the end, it was drops in the bucket. On Thursday, the leadership of FEMA finally found out about the 10,000 people in the convention center. In an interview the following day, Soledad O'Brien challenged them. How is it possible that we're getting better intel than you're getting? We had a crew in the air. We were showing live pictures of the people outside of the convention center. We had a National Guardsman who was talking to us, who was telling us he estimated the crowd of 50,000 people. That was 8 o'clock in the morning yesterday. And also, we've been reporting that officials have been telling people to go to the convention center if they want any hope of relief. I don't understand how FEMA cannot have this information. At the end of the day on Thursday, the now disgraced and a few years ago released from a 10-year prison sentence on federal corruption charges, Mayor Ray Nagin goes on national television and he begins to cry. Where are you? We are dying. We need help. And that was Thursday. On Friday, help arrives. Help arrives in the form of the 82nd Airborne Division, mobilized out of Fort Bragg, North Carolina. They are placed under the command of a man named Lieutenant General, that's a 3-star, Russell Honore. A native of southern Louisiana, General Honore understood the people and the terrain. And much, much more important, because he grew up here, he understood how hurricanes affect terrain. Because of his distinctive drawl when he spoke, a slight swagger when he walked, and a cigar that never seemed to leave his mouth, he was sometimes called the Black John Wayne. They said of General Honore that he hit the ground in New Orleans, he started screaming, and that was the moment that things started to happen. That is absolutely not true. General Honore did not wait to get to New Orleans before he started making things happen. Before his feet left the ground in North Carolina, he had ordered convoys of food and water to begin crossing hurricane-affected areas for immediate distribution. He contacted Fort Hood in Texas, Fort Benning in Georgia, Fort Sill in Oklahoma, and he asked them to do the same thing. They do. He then contacted the Navy, and he asked them to start sending relief ships full of supplies straight up the Mississippi River. They do. He then contacted the Air Force, and he asked them to fly over the hurricane-affected terrain and provide him with high-resolution photographs so that he could start making his evacuation plans immediately. They do. He then contacted the State Department, and he asked them to contact any foreign ships in the Gulf of Mexico willing to offer supplies, manpower, or simply empty berth space to help get the people out. They do. Mexico and China respond immediately. When he's in the air, General Honoré and his staff are going through pictures of the terrain provided by the Air Force to determine the routes that are available for the convoys that are now already rolling towards the city. They went through pictures of the city to determine where the water is, where the people are, where the distribution centers can be, where the exit points will be. He told the Signal Corps to reestablish communications within the city and logistics boys to start purifying and distributing water as soon as they hit the ground. Then, General Honoré landed in New Orleans. He started screaming, and things continued to happen. The 82nd Airborne hit this city hard. Highly trained, highly disciplined, very professional young men, the chaos in the streets ended, the looting of non-survival materials stopped, the gang members and the criminals with guns put them down. And a special unit was sent across the Mississippi River Bridge. And when they reached the Gretna Barricade, the Sheriff's Department decided that shooting at unarmed civilians was one thing, but they were not going to engage in a gun battle with the United States of America's, by God, 82nd Airborne Division. There was a very, very tense moment that almost went very, very bad. But in the end, no shots were fired. The sheriffs finally stood down. They lowered their weapons, they dismantled the barricade, and they opened the best way out of the city. And the convoys began rolling immediately. It took General Honoré and the 82nd 24 hours to evacuate the entire convention center and the Superdome. 50,000 people. After 5 days, they did it in one. And the people went by bus and by military trucks, by commercial flight and C-130 aircraft. They went to Washington State, to Maine, Florida, California, and every state in between. No state took more than Texas. No city more than Houston. They went to hotels and motels, to summer camps and school gymnasiums. They went to churches and to private citizens' homes who simply opened their doors to strangers. Especially in Utah's where that happened. Almost every single evacuee that landed in Utah ended up in a private citizen's home. And General Honoré issued a new evacuation order. If you are not actively part of the cleanup effort, you must leave. My aunt left then. My uncle did not. He is a retired Army chaplain with extensive and damn near comprehensive knowledge of New Orleans. But he spent the next few weeks assisting the 82nd in search and rescue operations, as well as performing last rites. The city emptied as the people dispersed, but the soul of the city survived. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be, for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of fate, my head is bloody, but unbowed. It matters not how straight the gate, or charged with punishments the scroll, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. And so the soul of the city survived. There was one bar left open in the French Quarter, and two musicians there played every single night. so that here in New Orleans, no matter how bad it got, the music never stopped. It took 6 weeks to get the water out of this city. When the levees are finally repaired and the water drained out, General Honoré lifted the evacuation order, and he personally called for the people to return. The first wave of people to come to New Orleans were volunteers. They came from every state in this country and from countries all over the world. They came with tools in their hands or just their hands. They came with skills or just a willingness to work. I was down here in December for Christmas break, back when I was in law school. No tools, no skills. And I was put to work tearing out rotten drywall from a single house that could be saved. And we did. We saved that house. As the federal aid, state aid, international donations, private charities, churches, personal gifts, and private investment poured back into the city, there was a wave of demand for skilled and unskilled labor. And the people of New Orleans came back to tear down, to clean up, and rebuild. Despite the predictions of some in the halls of power that the city had drowned, that the people would never return, they came back so quickly that AT&T, Verizon, the other telecom companies could not keep up with demand. No matter how fast they put up new cell phone towers, it wasn't fast enough. The people came back faster, and then faster, and then faster still. And so for months, it was impossible to use your cell phone as a cell phone. With landline service still sketchy all across the city, and not enough bandwidth for anyone to actually make a phone call, everyone in the city of New Orleans learned how to text to communicate. Everyone. Because for about 6 months, it was quite literally the only way we could do it. My 80-year-old grandparents came back to this city in November, just 2 weeks after the evacuation order was lifted. And they sent out a text message to my entire family saying that they had a new phone with big buttons. They have learned how to text, and this is how they're going to be communicating from now on. It was a good day. Well, it was a good day until, a few hours later, when it became obvious that now that my grandparents have learned how to text, they simply were not going to stop doing it. In January, the schools reopened and the children of New Orleans returned. That spring, there was a discussion about whether or not we should even have Mardi Gras. But it was decided that this city that has gone through fires and floods, disease and war, a city that was French, then Spanish, then French, then American, would not be bowed by another storm. Mardi Gras was held, and the people celebrated. Later, the Superdome, fully cleaned up, repaired, and reopened, housed the NCAA football championship. And the local favorite, the LSU Tigers, won that game. They became national champions here in the city, and the people celebrated. But that was nothing compared to what happened later. When, for the first time in this city's history, the Saints went marching in and won the Super Bowl, and the city exploded. This was much more than a football game. It was a hell of a lot more than a sporting event. It was a symbol and a rallying cry. Even my, at that point, 85-year-old grandmother, who'd never really watched a football game on television in her entire life, became a half-crazy Saints fan. Now, she may not have understood all the rules, but she painted her face for her society's Super Bowl party. And she never missed a game after that, every week when the Saints would play, right up until she was 92 years old. My grandmother would put on her Drew Brees jersey, pour a very tall glass of bourbon, and yell at the television. It's win after improbable win, coming from behind, beating the odds, took a city on its knees and brought them to their feet. It was a statement that we will not go gently into the night. We will rise from the ashes. We will rebuild what was broken. We will not bow before the storm. in true New Orleans fashion. Before that game was even played, we had declared a citywide holiday. Not for the day of the game, but for the day after the game. Because win or lose, we were going to have a party. And party we did. We shut down everything. Every single school in the city of New Orleans was released for the day. Every business that didn't serve alcohol closed their doors. We technically did not have the authority to shut down the state and federal court systems, and we just did it anyway. In the short time it took to get our saints back into this city, we'd already planned the parades, shut down the roads, opened up the warehouses, taken out the floats, and organized the marching bands. And those marching bands, in this city with its long and rich tradition of live music, are held in much greater esteem than other high schools, other areas around the country. And so it should be remembered as they march through those streets that almost every one of them, literally almost every single boy and girl, was a Katrina evacuee that had fled this city and then returned to it to play music once more in dried out streets in victory and celebration. Out of the dark Mississippi mud, I rise. Up from a past that was purchased with blood, I rise. Bearing the gifts our ancestors gave, I rise. The city still lifts above the night, above the wind, above the wave. I rise, I rise, I rise. And there you have it. That was my overly dramatic and maybe slightly cheesy narration of Hurricane Katrina. I am often asked what could be done to prevent this from happening again. And the answer is actually a lot more simple than you might think. Most of the real problems occurred because of the delay in the response. They would all have been much less, or at least lessened, if the response had been quick, if it had been responsive, so to speak. And so the answer is actually pretty simple. The United States military has the single greatest logistics experts that have ever existed in the history of humanity's militaries. They are literally the best at what they do. And what they do is train their entire lives and run missions, training exercises, and real-world war events that involve taking this stuff over here and moving it over there as fast as you possibly can, even if, and this is important, the infrastructure is completely broken. We have the best. We have the experts. Why not use them? I think it should be black letter law. In the same way that you can't sit on the Supreme Court without being a lawyer, you shouldn't be allowed to run FEMA if you're not an expert in emergency management and logistics. What we should do is take the experts from the Pentagon, take the generals that are about to retire, pick which one you want, and ask them, instead of retiring, to go down the road to run FEMA for a few years. And then when they retire, you just go to the next one, and then the next one, and then the next one. And if you did that, these problems would be radically lessened. They wouldn't happen in this way, because the delays wouldn't exist, and the speed that FEMA would then respond to natural disasters and emergencies would be much, much, much faster, more effective, and better. And in addition to that, and this is kind of the whole point, if you did do that, then the people at the top the people in charge would finally know what they're doing. But that's just me. I'm not in charge. This has been Storied History. Thank you for your continued support and your listenership. Is that a word? For the time being, this podcast is just a passion project. It's a creative outlet. And so sometimes it does take a backseat to other things that are going on in our lives. I'm not sure when they will be, but there will be other episodes to come. I still very much want to do one on the Republic of Pirates. I have a good idea about a grab bag of cool history stories and anecdotes that are all very short. One of them involving the logistics experts in World War II, the ones I was just talking about, and how some of the German generals learned, they realized that they were going to lose the war when they realized that the American GIs were being issued Lucky Strike cigarettes. I want to put that in there. Anyway, it's a cool story. And of course, I want to do more of my own Appalachian Trail stories. I don't know when they will be. All right, I'm going to go look for the next story. And if you hit the subscribe button, then you will get it when I get around to it.
Storied History is written and recorded by Charles Chestnut, with production and original music by Seamus O'Connor. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you for listening. Please like, subscribe, rate us, or leave a comment to help support what we do. This podcast is a labor of love, and no episode more so than this one. So thank you again for listening, and we'll see you in the next story.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.